The missing dimension to our conversation about the climate.
Climate change gets focused on as a political challenge, a technical challenge, a scientific challenge, an economic challenge. And it is all of those things. But I think there's this real danger that what's been forgotten here is a really sort of fundamental moral point, which is that this is about human lives being destroyed by the actions of other human beings. And that is probably about as central a moral crisis as you're going to find. So ultimately, this is about what we owe to each other and the way that we ought to treat each other as human beings and the way in which climate change is undermining that.
That's moral philosopher Elizabeth Cripps. Later, she tells us about her book, What Climate Justice Means and Why We Should Care. But first, Bruce Holsinger tells us about his novel, The Displacements. It's about what happens to a family when the first Category 6 hurricane hits the wealthy enclave of Coral Gables. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. There's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide in a world beset by the climate catastrophe, not even if you're rich. The leveling impact of climate change is at the heart of Bruce Holsinger's novel, The Displacements. It's a page-turning dive into what happens to people when climate-driven disasters take everything from them, and how they cope in an America where disaster response is ever more stretched to the breaking point. Bruce Holsinger is the author of the best-selling novel, The Gifted School. He teaches English at the University of Virginia. Bruce Holsinger, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Very, very happy to be here.
The Displacements is an example of the emerging genre of cli-fi, or climate fiction. What led you to write this book?
Well, I suppose what started me on this, the journey to write this novel was fear more than anything else. You know, fear for my kids and the future of climate change. It's dedicated to my two sons. A fear of acceleration, an anxiety about what the world's going to look like. I tend to shy away from the notion of cli-fi as a genre. I think we're at the point now where climate change, it's like writing about culture. It just is part of the fabric of the contemporary world. And I think that more and more novels of every stripe are engaging it as one of the central issues we're facing. So I tend to think of, I don't think of this as a climate novel. I think of it as a realist novel set in the very, very near future. It could take place a month from now. It could take place a year or 5 years from now. I'll leave that a little bit up in the air. But I wanted to engage the problem of climate catastrophe from the perspective of our moment, our very moment. It's not post-apocalyptic. It's not dystopian. It's very much set in the here and now. And I wanted to explore that, you know, our moment from that perspective.
And actually, that's a very heartening point of view, because if writing novels, fiction about the climate becomes more general, then that's an indication of more awareness in the culture in general.
Yes, exactly. There was a wonderful piece by Lydia Millett. I don't know if you've had her on your show, wrote the Children's Bible. And it argued against that, the idea of cli-fi as a genre. I think the title was even Don't You Dare Call It a Genre. And so I've been going around evangelizing about that, about, you know, wanting to stop thinking of this as kind of niche. It's just part of what fiction is now and has to be.
Now, as you say, this is set in the present or the very near future. The current year is predicted to have a higher than normal occurrence of hurricanes. And of course, we all know that hurricanes are getting stronger. The Displacement centers around a new category of hurricane. Luna is a Category 6. Talk about the science that pointed you in the direction of a Category 6 hurricane.
Well, there is no such thing as a Category 6 hurricane at the moment. And most most climatologists, most hurricane experts will tell you we don't need category 6 because a category 5 already reaches up into the stratosphere, as it were. It already accounts for a storm that could be as big as the one imagined in the book, because category 5 has no limit. And I knew that going in, but one of the things that fascinated me when I talked to people who had worked at the National Hurricane Center. I interviewed a couple of experts at the University of Miami who work on hurricanes in the Atlantic and the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico. And one of the things I learned is that in order to create a new designation, this would be done by the National Hurricane Center, which is lodged in the Department of Commerce, which is headed by the Secretary of Commerce, who reports directly to the president, is in the president's cabinet. So for me, it became a really interesting question of the politics of it. So there's a scenario. You learn why this new designation comes about fairly early in the novel. It's kind of explained by one of the side characters. It's very much a political decision made on the moment, and it's perfectly plausible that that could happen. You know, you'd have most hurricane experts I know would argue against creating a new designation, but it's in large part it's a political as much as a scientific problem. And so that to me, that created a really interesting perspective on bureaucracy and government dysfunction and so on. And it just, it became a kind of element in thinking about it. The science of it, I went in having done a lot of reading on what, future catastrophic hurricanes are going to look like, both in South Florida and in Houston, Galveston, which is where Luna goes after Florida. And, the experts I talked to, I came in thinking I kind of already had a sense of worst case scenarios. And I was shocked to hear them almost laugh at my somewhat rosy sense of how bad this could be. Even my novelist's capacity for, hyperbole was defeated by some of the things they told me. So, I'm no expert on the science. I was just almost transcribing the kinds of things that they described. But it is kind of staggering what these things are going to look like.
And give us an example of what shocked you.
Well, there was a hurricane, a strong hurricane, in what is now Miami back in the 19th century, and it turned what was one big island into a couple of different islands. And one of the effects of the storm surge and the strength of the waves in a hurricane imagined like Luna would be carving up Miami Beach into an archipelago of as many as, 10 or 15 islands. That's the kind of damage that the huge storm surge would be likely to do. Also the winds, Miami is the amount of wealth in and around Miami, right? I don't know if you've been there recently, but if you just take a boat ride around the area around Biscayne Bay, just to see the luxury built up right up against the water. It's right there. It's as almost as if these huge luxury condo buildings on some of these islands are almost seawalls. And the kinds of winds that a future hurricane might carry with it, there's just the level of destruction of wealth is just kind of unimaginable.
And talking about wealth, now let's talk about the family that's at the center of your book. The book actually really has a message about the leveling influence of climate chaos. In other words, whatever they may think, the rich are not immune from the effects, as you've just pointed out, although they may be delayed. But not in the case of this family, the Larson Halls. They're a wealthy white family that lives in, is it Coral Gables now? I don't remember.
Yeah, Coral Gables, which is a very affluent community, kind of on the edge of Miami, right up against Biscayne Bay. And this family, it's a truism going in that, and one of the characters says this very clearly, that catastrophic climate change right now is having a disproportionate effect on the lives of the poor, the already dispossessed. And that's true. But as you say, there's a leveling effect. And I really wanted to explore this from the perspective of an affluent family and kind of as a way of kind of shaking shoulders in a way. The book is about a family for the most part, about what a family goes through in the wake of this catastrophe. It's a story of downward mobility, but it's also a story of resilience. And, I wanted, from the point of view of a family, but surrounded by a much larger national context, I wanted to explore what resilience looks like and what that, you know, what are the resources for that? So I don't want to give your listeners the impression that this is just a, you know, sad, sobering disaster book. It's also a family drama with a lot of love, a lot of, you know, anger and frustration in the middle of it, just like my last novel, The Gifted School.
And in this novel, after Daphne and her kids, it's her two biological children, Mia and Oliver, and her stepson, older stepson, Gavin, they go to a FEMA shelter in Oklahoma. Tell us a little bit about that FEMA shelter and the resilience that they find within them.
Yes. Yeah. So the novel imagines the aftermath and how the federal and state governments respond, and how non-governmental organizations like the Red Cross, how they respond. So there are 18 mega shelters, as I imagine them, spread throughout the American South. Some are on old college campuses that have been abandoned. Some are in stadiums. Some are in army bases and so on. But, you know, it's a way of trying to find housing, shelter, food for, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who have been displaced for several months. You know, how do you do that? And the one that this family goes to, it's called Tule Farm. It's just imagined. But, you know, it's at the old State Botanical Gardens, and there's already some facilities there. There's water. And one of the characters who's not in the family is Rain Holton, and she works for FEMA, and she's basically the person running the camp and supervising the staff. And I, you know, that was the most challenging part of the novel, was imagining what this would look like. And I read so many government documents from FEMA and other agencies, Department of Homeland Security, about things like crime in government shelters, or what about firearms? What happens if a sexual offender tries to check into a federal shelter? There's rules and regulations for everything. It's just kind of unimaginable the amount of government documents that have been generated, especially in the wake of Katrina, and, you know, all the disasters around the Katrina aftermath, about, you know, housing logistics and so on. So I got really into those details. Of course, you know, my first two novels were historical novels. One of the dangers of that kind of writing is that you'll give too much detail. And so paring that down, figuring out what to use was one of the challenges. But creating that shelter, making it realistic, making it human, you know, the book begins kind of in medias res in a scene that comes a couple weeks into the family's sojourn in this shelter. And it's a children's game. And all the hundreds of children in Tule Farm have made up this game that they're playing. And I just thought that's a source of resilience, of how children find new ways of making a home, even in these very straitened circumstances.
Yeah, even more so than the adults, who seem pretty shell-shocked.
Yes. Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. But you think about it, you know, you're, as long as you're getting three meals a day, you go to a big open air shelter and you're basically at a camp out with hundreds of other kids, you know? So I was trying to give the magic of it through the kids' eyes in a way that, you know, as long as they're safe, as long as they're okay, what sources of fun they'll find, you know, how they, you know, for Mia, who was being bullied back at her school, had real trouble with these other, you know, snobby kids. She finds the best friend she's ever had in Tule Farm. And I thought, you know, that's a very realistic kind of scenario for a kid like her.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Bruce Holsinger about his newest novel, The Displacements. Now, you talk about the Tule Farm, the FEMA shelter, and you also have another thread in the book, which is a report on the migration, a report called The Great Displacement, which is described as a digital chronicle of the Luna yes. migration. One of the things it talks about is that, it says, most of the people who go to a FEMA shelter are people of color, something that makes a federal response all the more predictable. So talk about this angle of race, even more maybe than class, although class is certainly there because most of the people are also low income. Talk about the impact of those social factors on the federal response to shelter.
Yeah. What you're talking about in the novel is this digital chronicle. And I you know, when I'm not writing fiction, I'm an academic, and a lot of my colleagues work in this field called digital humanities. So this is a sort of university-sponsored project, and you see little glimpses of it. It's not a lot of the book. You only see it 8 or 9 times. But it includes, you know, charts and graphs. It includes interviews with various people, like, you know, a meteorologist who was on screen when the hurricane's designation as Category 6 came in, a former governor of Florida who ordered an evacuation too late. One of the people that you see is a disaster studies specialist, a woman who is from Puerto Rico and was a refugee from Puerto Rico, displaced from there after Hurricane Maria. And she's now a disaster studies specialist. And she has a very kind of cynical view about how Hurricane Luna was covered and how, you know, the white population at Tule Farm became such a kind of central media focus. So you're seeing all of this, that whole project, you're seeing a retrospective view of the story told in real time in the novel. You know, there's a lot of separatism, racial separatism that goes on at Tule Farm and in the other shelters. There's a group of whites who live in this neighborhood that they established. They ironically call it Cracker Town, but it does become kind of an engine for factionalism and racial division. And I wanted, you know, there's a lot of work in disaster studies that is, you know, really, really wonderfully talks about the communities, helpful mutual communities that form in the wake of catastrophe. And that's definitely true. And that's one thing I wanted to explore. But I also, you know, the catastrophe has a long tail, and there's also can be potential for division and dissent in the wake of catastrophe. And I wanted to be very honest and upfront about that as well.
And one of the themes that comes in there with the racial animosity, you know, emanating from Cracker Town, which of course comes out of, you know, fear, and conspiracy theories, but it is a theme of toxic masculinity, how that works into there. Talk about that theme, because it also shows up in some of the other characters.
Yeah, and that was a theme I got really interested in. I don't know. I mean, it's just such a theme of our moment. And it's one of my readers said, you know, the men in the novel don't come across particularly well. And I think that's true. And it was only at the end that I realized, well, maybe I need to give at least Gavin a break. But so one of the characters is named Tate, and he's an insurance agent in Houston, but he's also a drug dealer. He's selling this new opioid called Wildfire. And he decides with his girlfriend sidekick to go to this mega shelter and sell there and kind of, you know, take this huge trove of this stuff so his dealers don't find him while Houston is being destroyed. But he also listens to this podcast, and you see little excerpts of it by, I don't even remember what it's called. Me Lads. And it's by a kind of British toxic masculine, like I think the British equivalent of Ben Shapiro or Jordan Peterson, someone like, you know, these really appalling kind of figures who, you know, are so worried about masculinity and are trying to, you know, shape new men for the new era. But in the process kind of replicate so many of the awful, you know, most awful tendencies around that kind of discourse. And so that was in there. And then Daphne's husband, you learn some things about him. But Daphne, even though Gavin is her stepson, not her son, her biological son, she's really worried about these tendencies that she sees in him and is really trying to push him away from them and help him cultivate, you know, a better way of living, a better way of being a man. And so that was a theme that I found very natural as a way to think about not so much a catastrophe, but just about family relations and the models of mentorship that a guy like Gavin, you know, dropping out of college, being forced to drop out of college, and now living in all places in a FEMA mega shelter during what should be the first quarter of his sophomore year. You know, how's that going to impact someone like that? And what's that going to do? And then, you know, it goes with that theme of downward mobility in the novel and thinking about, especially, you know, white male downward mobility and what that does to our culture at the moment. I, you know, it's not the central theme of the novel, but it's one that I wanted in there. It became important to me as I wrote.
What also struck me is that tendency of toxic masculinity actually puts at risk the safety of the camp, the safety of the family. In other words, it erodes the resilience of people in the face of disaster.
Yes, it does. And it's one of many things that erodes the resilience. There's also government, waning support from the government for these shelters. There's kind of indifference. There's one point where Daphne has been in the shelter for a couple of months, and she has a copy of USA Today that I have her reading, and she realizes, oh my God, like the Hurricane Luna, the greatest catastrophe in U.S. history, is not even on the front page anymore. And that's just a moment of kind of shock that she feels. And you understand it with something like COVID, which has killed over 1 million people in the United States. But, very often you'll open the newspaper and it won't even be on the front page. And, it's the way that our culture kind of moves itself away from seeing catastrophe. And I think that's a particularly American tendency in some ways. This kind of oblivion that can be really shocking to see, but in some ways that we all participate in.
Yes, our tendency to not remember.
Yes.
Now, talk a little bit more about the holes in our disaster response system that you discovered and that are revealed in this novel. I mean, the director of the FEMA camp that you mentioned, Lorraine Holton, she's caring, she's competent, but she gets completely overwhelmed.
Yeah. And she gets overwhelmed not just by the immensity of the job, but by the bureaucracy that she has to report up to. In fact, one of the things that really inspired this book was reading around in refugee studies and thinking about refugees versus IDPs. And that's a really crucial distinction. And it's a very novelistic distinction. It's perfectly suited for a novel. Refugees, by definition, are displaced people who cross international borders, whereas internally displaced people are people who are displaced, but they stay within recognized national borders. Now, of course, there's a huge fuzzy area between those categories. In the wake of Katrina, there was so much terminological disputes around, whether these are refugees. If we call them refugees, it makes them seem like they're not Americans, right? They can be kind of cast in a different way. And one of the things I learned is that the U.S., despite that, has, if there were a huge crowd of, hundreds of thousands of actual refugees, legally, juridically, and so on, we have a much clearer regulations and policies around how to house them, treat their legal status, their documentary status, versus internally displaced people. They're actually the practices, the best practices, as they're called, the bureaucracy, the regulations around how to deal with large populations of internally displaced people. It's really rudimentary and it just hasn't been thought out. And it's one of the things that's very worrisome about what climate change and climate displacement is going to look like in the United States is the rules and regulations for what government can and can't do. The eminent domain, the takings, the emergency actions that executives, governors and presidents will have to take. One of the interesting problems for me was, Daphne's in this shelter. She's been in there for a few weeks and she thinks, well, if I were back in Miami, what would be happening? My kids would be in school. So she goes to the local public school. She gets a ride from one of the volunteers at the shelter and tries to enroll her kids. And the superintendent of the school system says, well, no, we have special dispensation from the governor. You guys aren't considered residents. And Daphne says, what do you mean? We are residents. We're here. And he said, no, the law has been clearly defined by the governor. And, you could take us to court if you want, but it'll take you a few months. By then you'll be gone. And so there's that kind of hostility from local populations who don't want to take in an additional 20,000-30,000 resident and have to deal with all the logistical nightmares that creates. So that's, it's just one of many examples of the kind of thing that I was dealing with. And a novel is not an op-ed. Right. Nor is it a policy document. It is a work of imagination. And so these are not things that I try to resolve in the novel. They're obstacles in the way of my characters. They're kind of psychological and logistical barriers that they have to face. And that, is just one of many that I was conjuring when I was putting the displacements together.
And the novel is a total page turner, I have to say. So, and there's, you know, it's not a dry tome by any means. Finally, my final question is that in the report, The Great Displacement, the digital chronicle of the Lunit migration, one point it makes is the impact of climate catastrophe on mental health. Tell us what you found out about that.
Yeah. So one of the characters that you get her kind of a first person testimonial just for a page or so. She's an addiction nurse working in a hospital in Texas. And she's dealing with a lot of patients who have succumbed to opioid addiction in the wake of Luna. And she had worked on early hurricanes before. I think I have her talking about, you know, having worked with people who were affected by Harvey. And that, you know, that the substance abuse, mental health challenges, suicide rates, self-harm, all of that just spikes in the wake of catastrophes. I mean, we're seeing it with COVID, obviously, and in the wake of sudden, you know, monumental catastrophes like a massive hurricane, where people are losing their housing, they're losing their communities, family members, basic stability. It's an enormous mental health challenge, and that challenge involves, you know, it intersects with the opioid crisis, with the housing crisis, let alone with you know, an environmental crisis. So those factors all are kind of intersecting with each other and create this snowball effect of catastrophe for the victim. So that's something that I thought about a lot. You know, in every one of these strands, you know, there was a point where I was thinking, you know, why am I dealing with this affluent family? Why not deal with a you know, lower middle class white family that is you know, dealing with this catastrophe in their own ways? And so, you know, it just every one of these could be a novel. Every strand could be a novel in its own right, but you have to pick and choose. But I wanted to, one of the reasons I put that digital chronicle in there, and again, you only see it a few times, but you know, this is a family drama, it's a story of a family, but I wanted to paint this story on a much larger canvas and without having huge information dumps for the reader, without having too much exposition explaining what's going on nationally. So that was a way of doing it, of widening the lens, but in these quick ways that would keep the reader turning pages.
And indeed, I did continue turning pages. Bruce Holzinger, it's just been great to talk with you about this novel, The Displacements. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Bruce Holzinger. Find an excerpt from The Displacements by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, what does the climate crisis mean for morality? Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. At the very heart of the climate crisis is the question, what is our responsibility to our fellow humans, future generations, and all the other living beings we share the planet with? In other words, it's about what climate justice means and why we should care. That's the title of my guest Elizabeth Cripp's book. She's a moral and political philosopher. We spoke last month about her book and the moral dimensions of the climate crisis. Let's hear that conversation. Elizabeth Cripps, you're a philosopher, a moral philosopher, and the perspective of this book, which I am so glad to be seeing because I think it's a perspective that is all too often ignored, is that climate is a moral issue. So talk about the link between moral philosophy and climate.
Yes, I think there's a real danger, as you say, that climate change gets focused on as a political challenge, a technical challenge, a scientific challenge, an economic challenge. And it is all of those things. But I think there's this real danger that what's been forgotten here is a really sort of fundamental moral point, which is that this is about human lives being destroyed by the actions of other human beings. And that is probably about as central a moral crisis as you're going to find. So ultimately, this is about what we owe to each other and the way that we ought to treat each other as human beings and the way in which climate change is undermining that.
And you use what you call a philosopher's toolbox. And I just loved the way you bring forth these kind of moral principles and apply them to the issue at hand, to climate change, to climate justice. One of these concepts that you talk about is one that I believe was developed by John Stuart Mill, do no harm. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. So yes, this is, it's probably most famously expressed in Western philosophy by John Stuart Mill. It's called like the no harm principle or sometimes the liberty principle, but it's a principle or moral view which is widely shared across a lot of different philosophies and indeed different religious worldviews as well. So this is the fundamental idea that, well, if we owe anything to each other as human beings, we owe it to each other not to do serious harm. So it is wrong, if anything's wrong, it's wrong to kill somebody, it's wrong to maim them, it's wrong to make them seriously ill. And actually, all we need to do really is start with that, and we can see climate change as the moral crisis that it is.
Give us some examples of that.
I start the book actually with some individual examples, cases, really harrowing cases of true stories. For example, the family that was after Hurricane Katrina, essentially just sort of floating around in this horrible flooded water, having been driven from one kind of point of refuge. They were floating on this very inadequate inflatable raft, just trying to stay alive. Or the example of the situation that's going to be faced in many parts of the world, and is already the case in lots of Africa, the situation where farmers, subsistence farmers, are just literally unable to produce enough food for their families to survive. Or we can talk about lives that are being destroyed by wildfires, about the fact that malaria is on the increase because of rising temperatures. We can talk about the extreme weather events which are increasing, so the floods that we're seeing in many parts of the world. All of these are cases where people are being seriously harmed. Often they're being killed, they're losing their homes, and they're losing their livelihoods. These are clear human rights violations. And yes, there's not, you know, a straight link. You can't say this one person caused this, but we can say that this is happening because of carbon emissions, which are making climate change worse and making it more likely that these kind of extreme weather events will occur.
It's not just people losing their lives, their communities, their homes, but also their culture. Talk about the connection between cultural genocide, one might say, and the failure to act to prevent climate change.
So one thing that I discovered when I was researching for the book is, yeah, the ways in which climate change is destroying cultures because of the impact that it has on glaciers and the cultural role, the spiritual role that glaciers play in many communities, for example, in parts of South America, that the whole sort of spiritual and cultural well-being of society can be bound up in the survival of these glaciers, which are essentially melting because of climate change.
Now, what is the difference between the principle of do no harm and the principle of duty to protect? I mean, one sounds negative, not in a moral sense, but it's do not do something, and the other is do something that's positive. What's the distinction between them?
That's a pretty core distinction in moral philosophy, although some people would argue that actually it shouldn't be considered such a stark distinction between the two. But yes, on the one hand, we talk about negative duties, duties not to harm people, not to violate their rights. And on the other hand, we talk about positive duties, so the obligations that we have to help people who are in serious need, even if we didn't cause the plight that they're in. And the sort of archetypal positive duty is what a philosopher, Peter Singer, talks about as the principle of beneficence. So he has this example. He says, well, look, if a child is drowning and you could save them, and yeah, you're on your way to work and it would make you a bit late and it would maybe damage your new shoes, but you could do it. It's just completely intuitively clear that you should do that. It's a moral basic. And I think while it's not quite as universally accepted as the no harm principle, it's still pretty fundamental to morality that if you can easily save somebody else's life, if it's not going to cost you that much, you really have a pretty clear-cut moral duty to do it. And again, that's another way in which we can say, well, the global rich, those who are well off, who have the resources to do this, should really be making the effort to tackle climate change. We shouldn't be leaving it to the most vulnerable.
Let's drill down on that a little bit. Duty to protect. You just mentioned the global rich. You talk about some of the excuses that people put forth, which is that, you know, I have a duty to protect my family, but I don't have a duty to protect somebody I don't know. Why do we have a duty to protect those we don't know?
So I think that's really interesting. There are arguments, I think plausible arguments, that say we owe more to the people that are closest to us. So we owe more. I think I owe more to my own children than I owe to everybody else. There's certain things I have to do for them because they're my children, and that applies to other people that we're close to. Arguably, it applies to people in our state that we share a state with, or people that are part of our own community. But that doesn't mean that we don't have any moral responsibilities to other people. So again, we can say, well, look, yes, maybe, possibly very plausibly, I should be doing more to make my children's lives better than I have to do for other people. But that doesn't mean that I can seriously harm other people, that I can violate their rights in the process. And actually, we could say, well, really, I still have some basic responsibilities to protect other people if I can do that, even if it means maybe, you know, making my children's lives slightly less luxurious than they would otherwise be. And of course, actually, in the climate change case, using the example of our children makes it very clear that we should be taking action on climate change, because, of course, this is an intergenerational injustice. So our children are also the ones who are under threat.
You said before we have a duty to protect others if we can do so easily. Why that qualification? And I'm asking that in particular because, as you point out in this book, there's a difference between the rich nations. I mean, there's a difference between rich people on the one hand. I believe you say the top 1% emit more carbon than the bottom 90%, which is a pretty shocking.
It really is.
Statistic when you think about it, the bottom 90. Okay. So one can assume it'd be pretty easy for them to give up maybe a portion of their billions to helping other people. But there's also the notion that the rich countries that have been emitting carbon for far longer than the poor countries and continue to emit more than the poor countries owe it to the poor countries to transition to clean energy or to compensate for the ravages of climate change. Talk about that.
So yeah, the statistic in the book, I'm not sure which one you're referring to, but I think that the one that I talk about is the richest 1% produce more than twice as much as the poorest half of the world in terms of global emissions. So yes, we clearly have a situation where it's a relatively small, very small proportion of people who are doing most of the harm here and who are also in a position to change it. So, I mean, in terms of why the qualification, Peter Singer, the philosopher who originally came up with this, actually wouldn't qualify it. He would just say you should help someone else, even if it would cost you almost as much to save them. So long as it wouldn't cost you more to save them than the threat is to them, you should do it. But most people and a lot of philosophers would kind of intuitively think, well, actually, there are some limits to what morality can demand of us. And so because I'm trying to start by saying, well, look, here's a couple of really uncontroversial moral rules. All we need to do is accept them, which most people do, and we can see climate change as a fundamental injustice. So I accept the caveat for that and say, well, look, even if we say that we only need to save the people we can do relatively easily, we should clearly be taking action on climate change. And yes, when it comes to the responsibility of different states, there are, I think, whichever moral line you take, so whether you say, well, it should be the polluters, the harmers, who pay for the costs of tackling climate change, or whether you should say it should be those who are most able to do so, so that they can protect the vulnerable, or even if you say it should be the people who have benefited most from fossil fuel use. Whichever way you go, you tend to identify the so-called global elite, the world's richest. And actually, interestingly, the big corporations would have significant responsibilities here.
I want to draw a parallel to the rescuers of Jews during World War II, however, in this qualification. Many of them put their lives on the line, and many of them said, I had to do it, that this was just something that needed to be done. And I really wonder that at a time when, and I'm not saying that individuals are the ones who are mostly responsible, and because we'll get into that, and I completely agree with you that this is both from a practical and a moral point of view, it's not up to individuals to change this. But nonetheless, the idea that we have a duty to protect others in a situation where if we don't unite and protect each other, we're all going to fall. And then to also think of those situations in during World War II where people did put everything on the line because that's what had to be done to save others. I just wonder if we can't push that envelope a little bit more to say that we need to think more about the choices we make, even if at first it seems more uncomfortable to us.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really interesting that you say that. Actually, that's something that I've been thinking about a lot myself recently and thinking about as a philosopher as well, this kind of question of, well, how much should we be giving up? How much should we be doing to try and get action going on this? Because it is such a huge global emergency. And there's certainly an argument to be made that says, well, actually, we really should be doing a lot here. And there are individual climate activists, particularly in countries in the global south, who have sacrificed everything. I mean, we hear about the murders of activists, for example, in South America. Environmental activists really do put their lives on the line. And here in the UK as well, we see activists who are going to jail or being prepared to go to jail in pursuit, essentially, of climate justice. So there are absolutely examples of many individuals who I think must believe, clearly do believe exactly what you say there, but look, in this situation, we do put ourselves on the line.
Yeah. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Elizabeth Cripps about her book, What Climate Justice Means and Why We Should Care. Now let's talk about future generations. First of all, from a moral philosophy point of view, why should we protect them? And some of the excuse thinking that goes around with the practice of discounting the future. Explain that.
There's a big debate in philosophy, which we don't need to go into in any detail, about how much we owe to future generations and about whether they should be left a life as good as ours, or whether what matters is simply to leave them a good life, a decent life, the opportunities to live a full human life. But actually, again, what is pretty much undeniable, I think, is that we are talking about human beings here, whether they're in this generation or the next. And that means that there are certain basics that we owe them and that it would be wrong to do to them. So there's a philosopher, Henry Shue, who has an example where he says, well, look, imagine that I feel like just planting some landmines for fun. That's the kind of person I am. And I'm going to plant them on a really popular tourist trail. Now, he says, if I do that, I don't know exactly who's going to be harmed, who's going to be killed. But I do know that what I do is going to seriously harm people. There's a very high chance that that will happen. And then he says, well, imagine that I set these to go off in 100 or 150 years' time. So that there's no way anybody who's going to be killed or harmed then has been born today. Does that mean that it's okay? Does that make it acceptable that we're doing this to human beings just because they haven't come into existence yet? Clearly, it's still morally very wrong to do that kind of harm. So clearly, I think we do owe a lot to future generations. And of course, we can look at it another way and come back to what we talked about earlier and say that, well, we bring future generations into existence. So arguably we owe more to them on those grounds. Or we can think about it in terms of stewardship and the fact that when we think about the world and the climate and the natural resources that it has, why should we assume that they're just ours to squander as a generation, rather than tap into this idea that many indigenous philosophies, as well as some Western philosophers, have developed and argued to say, well, look, actually, this is a case where we should just be protecting and be stewards of these natural resources for future generations.
And Elizabeth Cripps, doesn't this also imply the question of who gets to decide? It's not just about the future. It's also about who gets to decide about the other beings with whom we share the planet, who gets to decide about the other humans who live in other countries. Today, I read in the New York Times that the government of the Congo is saying we don't have a duty to protect the planet, and therefore they're selling off the rainforest to oil drilling. I mean, they just came out and said that. Who gets to decide, and what does that mean in terms of the moral philosophy of climate justice?
That's such a good question, because the other aspect of justice and climate justice is this, well, it's partly about what happens to people and who gets what. But it's also about, well, who makes the decisions? It's about the idea that actually, as human beings, we have a right to have a say in the things that will decide how we can live our lives and the kind of future that we will have. And actually, when it comes to the decisions about climate change, there are huge participatory injustices, which actually tend to be along very similar lines to the kind of injustices in terms of the harms done. So it tends to be the global south. It tends to be particularly people of colour, black communities, indigenous communities, either at a global level or within richer countries, who tend to be both feeling the impacts of climate change worse, who have done least to cause it, and who are shut out most from decision making. And it's also women. It tends to be women who are worst harmed by climate change and are getting less of a say in the decision making. So we have this situation where there is a huge gap in terms of who decides and who actually feels the impact of climate change. And that's something that we see at individual country level, but also we see in terms of the global process of decision making. It tends to be the richer agents, the richer companies, the richer corporations, the richer individuals who have much more sway when it comes to deciding what will happen.
So now to the intersectionality that you talk about in this book. You say that to address the climate crisis, we need to address the issue of intersectionality. Say more about that.
The sort of basic idea of intersectionality, which I'm borrowing from Kimberly Crenshaw, is this idea that, well, when we are trying to understand the injustices that go on and the way that a particular group can be harmed or discriminated against, we can't just focus on the kind of big ticket dividers and say, well, this is about race or this is about gender, because it can be about both. So, for example, women of colour can be impacted in general and by climate change in ways that we won't understand so long as we sort of focus only on well, this is a racial injustice, this is a gender injustice. And of course it is both, but it's also an intersectional injustice, because if we introduce policies that will tackle the race injustice by making things better only for black men, or tackle the gender injustice by focusing on policies that make things better for white women, you still have this group who tend to be the ones who are most harmed by climate change, who remain unprotected and unhelped. So it's really important to make sure that it's those groups who are at the intersections of the different categories that tend to be the victims of injustice that get the focus on. And women of colour are the key group here, but actually it also applies in many other ways. So climate change affects many other groups who are already disadvantaged. So for example, if we think about disability or we think of the LGBT community, they will often suffer worse because of climate change. And then if they are in two communities, say disabled, black community, for example, could be suffering in a way that we won't properly understand unless we think about that particular group.
This becomes quite salient, Elizabeth Cripps, when you talk in your book in What Climate Justice Means and Why We Should Care about the issue of population control. There are those who say, and I think it makes sense, right? There are those who say that this earth cannot support the amount of population that we have. And I believe James Lovelock has said that the carrying capacity of the earth is 2 billion people. What's wrong with this picture, and what might be the right way to address overpopulation?
So the problem with this picture is that this isn't just a question of numbers of people. It's a question of the total impact on the climate. And so actually, and the sort of statistics that we were talking about already make this very clear, it's the extremely high emissions of a comparatively small group of people that have caused the problem. And there is a real danger in talking about population of making this sort of using it as a way to shift responsibility away from the world's rich and focus it on countries where population growth is still on the increase. And so there are real concerns about the way in which sometimes the sort of population debate has gone, because it can very quickly lead to huge human rights violations. And the way I think that it makes sense to think about it is, well, look, there are reasons, basic justice reasons, to care about reproductive justice. So to care about making sure that individuals have access to family planning, or more generally and crucially, the kind of healthcare, including reproductive healthcare, and the means to decide genuinely for themselves whether they want to have children. Providing that kind of justice matters fundamentally in itself. Actually, probably a side effect of that would be decreasing population rates, but that should never be the target, because it just becomes far too dangerous if that's the case. This has to be about reproductive justice for its own sake. And yes, there may then be demographic consequences that could make it easier to tackle climate change in the long run, potentially. But as we've seen, I mean, actually, because of the way in which it tends to be a very small proportion of the population of the world that are producing by far the biggest emissions, you know, stopping population growth without stopping the emissions of those people who are doing this would do very little.
Yes, but it's a really difficult issue, because the reason people in the global south are producing so much fewer emissions is because their standard of living is so much lower. And we want to raise the standard of living of people throughout the world. And so it does imply that at some point we're going to reach planetary limits. I mean, I think as you point out, and as the drawdown movement also points out, one of the most impactful things you can do is to educate women and girls, because women and girls who are educated and who have access to family planning, those two things tend to go together, will have less children. But it doesn't mean that overpopulation isn't an issue when it comes to climate change.
So yes, educating women and girls, a lot of charities and NGOs and others have sort of stressed the importance of this. But I think the point to make is that these kind of measures, which are good in themselves anyway, are important anyway. I mean, it's a matter of, you know, basic gender justice, that there is genuinely free and accessible availability of family planning, that there is education and opportunity for girls and women. That matters in itself. But there are concerns that if these can be introduced in two ways, right? These policies could be introduced because they're important for gender justice and reproductive justice. And then, yes, they would have demographic side effects, which would also potentially be helpful for tackling climate change. But if they're introduced in another way, if they are basically made kind of demographic targets, so the aim of these policies is explicitly to reduce population growth, then they can very quickly, a number of feminists have raised this really serious worry, which is that, well, then it becomes the case that those policies are introduced in a way that actually can make life worse for women rather than better. So, for example, you could end up with policies which focus narrowly on the pill or other forms of birth control because they're the most effective at reducing birth rates, when in fact, reproductive justice would also mean that there was free and available access to condoms, because they also protect against STDs. So the focus needs to be on women's health if this is going to be done in a just way.
And now, finally, to individuals. We touched on this before. What is your stance on what individuals can do about climate change?
So I think the most important thing that we can and should do as individuals is try and promote collective change. So the short answer is we should all be activists. And I'm understanding that in a broad way. There's a lot of things that you can do as an activist. But the reason I think this is the most important, and I think this actually comes down to another reason why a lot of people feel a lot of concern about the way in which the population debate sometimes goes, which is that actually anything which focuses too much on individuals and says, oh, you should be having fewer children or you should be cutting your emissions, is almost in danger of giving a free pass to the big corporations and governments who are essentially driving this crisis. So I think the most important thing that we can do, the thing that's fairest and most effective, is to try and promote that kind of collective change, to be activists. But as part of that, actually, we should also be worrying, I think, about our own carbon footprint. So I do think that it can be one way of being an activist is to be part of a lifestyle movement, moving towards being vegan or not flying, for example. All of these are things that we can and should think about, because we don't want to be complicit in these collective harms. But the most important thing, I think, is that we focus on what's going on at the collective level. We try and put pressure on governments to change and to force the big fossil fuel companies to change, because unless that happens, then it's not going to be possible to tackle climate change.
Well, it's a wonderful and very thought-provoking book, What Climate Justice Means and Why We Should Care. Elizabeth Cripps, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for giving me this chance.
Elizabeth Cripps is a moral and political philosopher and writer, specializing in climate justice and parental duties. She teaches at the University of Edinburgh and is Associate Director of Critique, the Center for Ethics and Critical Thought. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.